can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Well, my goodness gracious, let me tell you the news. My head's been wet with the midnight dew. I've been down on bended knee, talking to the man from Galilee. He spoke to me with a voice so sweet, I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He called my name and my heart stood still when he said, John, go do my will. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. Tell him that God's gonna cut him down. You can run on.
God's gonna cut him down. Johnny Cash. This is Doug Bennett, your host for Unspun. Unspun is an experiment in truth-telling. Excuse me. My co-host today is Doug Craig, Redding's clinical psychologist and local advocate for climate change action. His blog, Climate of Change, is at blogs, blogs.redding.com/dcraig. Dr. Craig is also an underwriter at KKRN in support of independent media. Thanks for coming in today, Doug. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here, Doug, as always.
Okay.
That's two Dougs in the studio.
Yeah, well, we got a Doug B and a Doug C. That's the way it works. My other guest in the studio today is Paul Hughes. He's come up from San Francisco to be with us. He has been the executive director of Forest Forever since 1993 and of Forest Forever Foundation since its founding in 1998. Prior to that, he was a program director with the San Francisco-based California League of Conservation Voters, where he received its Outstanding Leadership Award in 1992. Paul was executive director of Sonoma County Bar Association in Santa Rosa from 1985 to 1989 and has served in both paid and volunteer capacities in the environmental movement since 1974. He is a holder of a BA in journalism. He has worked as an environmental beat reporter and general assignment feature and sports writer for various newspapers in the Midwest, as well as a magazine freelancer and legislative aide. The Forest Forever website is at www.forestforever.org. Paul will be on the panel today at the Forum for the Forest event at the First United Methodist Church at 1825 East Street in Redding. That's on the corner of South and East Street in Redding at 1 o'clock through 5 p.m. in the social hall of the First United Methodist Church. So welcome to Unspun, Paul.
Thank you.
Well, today I think we're going to try to focus. I know one of Paul's strengths is working with government and other agencies to try to preserve forests. Am I right?
Yep.
Yeah, so maybe you can tell us a little about your work in that area and what we should be thinking about as far as the health of our forests.
Well, when I tell folks that we're an environmental advocacy group and that we're fighting to protect forests, a lot of folks, even really well-educated people, sort of draw a blank on what I'm talking about. So I just tell them we're tree huggers. Tree huggers.
Yeah.
We're the
tree
Lorax.
Huggers unite.
we fight for policies, mostly in Sacramento. Laws and rules that will protect forests, but we're not against logging. We're not an anti-timber harvesting organization. We are in favor of sustainable logging practices, and I can define that more if we have time or if you'd like. Basically, it means not clear-cutting, not taking everything, protecting old growth, protecting streams and waterways. And we do it primarily by lobbying the lawmakers in Sacramento, including the executive branch. So we are a bit unique in that we have the ability to lobby with virtually all of our resources, Now, our foundation does minimal lobbying, but our other entity, Forest Forever, is a so-called 501c4 type nonprofit, a little rarer breed, and we lobby with it. So we're working on bills right now in Sacramento mainly.
Is there a bill that we should know about that's going through the legislature?
Yeah, I could talk a lot about a very bad bill we're fighting, but let me start off on a positive note and mention we sponsored a bill called Assembly Bill 380. Its author is Wes Chesbro, a Democrat from Arcata. And what it would do is lock down the development of scientific methodologies and techniques to, for the first time, comprehensively measure the effects on watersheds from logging, which are myriad and are supposed to be getting measured and regulated but have not been. It's the most glaring loophole in forest practices in California. It's a failure to measure so-called cumulative watershed effects. It's required in the law that that happen. What's happening now is a complete joke, and our bill would take a giant leap toward closing that loophole and measuring those effects. And it has passed its House of Origin, the Assembly. It's now in the Senate Appropriations Committee, and we're urging folks to write letters to free the bill and get it onto the governor's desk by the end of the session.
So that was
AB 380.
AB 380. Yep. Okay, well, we'll try to remember that one.
Okay.
And what's the other one?
The other one is Senate Bill 455, which is a very bad bill. It was introduced by none other than Fran Pavley, who's a very green legislator. In fact, Fran Pavley, a Democrat from L.A., authored the Assembly Bill 32, the Global Warming Solutions Act of 2006. So we love her, but in a well-meaning effort to streamline things for the industry in a tough economy and at the same time raise the bar and create higher environmental standards in the forests, she's created something that's unenforceable, unworkable, counterproductive, and would set us back many decades in forest protection. And if you'd like, I can go into detail about that one. But
well, go ahead. Yeah, let's talk about the clear cutting aspect of local logging. I see beautiful old growth trees going down the highway here. It's it worries me, and I don't know where it's going since we have no construction industry. I'm wondering what's the deal, because we seem to be logging and doing a lot of clear cutting, and maybe Doug Craig would want to talk to the effects of clear cutting, or you, Paul, either one. Let me remind our listeners, we are a call-in show, and the number here is 337-1885, 337-1885. If you have any questions for either of our guests, please call in.
Well, I'll tackle your query about where the logs are going. They are going to the usual places, as you might imagine, domestic sawmills. But unfortunately, and this is a lesser known fact, the Forest Service estimated and came out with a report in November that log and lumber exports to China from Northern California, Oregon, and Washington in the first 9 months of 2011 were greater than in all months of 2010. And about a quarter of the lumber that's exported is from Northern California. The main drivers are in decreased U.S. demand, which you mentioned, the housing slump, but also increased demand in Asia, China in particular, due to urbanization and domestic infrastructure growing so fast. But the Forest Service said that in the 5 years ending in 2010, log exports to China increased 40-fold. Now, that's doubly bad news, because we need those jobs kept here. And if we want to strengthen the employment base in wood products, we need to keep the logs here so that we can create jobs turning them into furniture and stuff, not sending those jobs overseas.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. We need, and that's one of the arguments, because people that do work in logging here say, well, it's my job, and why would you want to stop that? And of course, Mayor Lee made the point, and some of our callers last show made the point that if you were more selective in your logging, you would actually have more mm-hmm. people working. It wouldn't be a slash and burn operation.
Better paying jobs as well.
Yeah, yeah.
The more value-added manufacturing jobs, the more things you can do with the wood, all the way up to the end user, the better paying the jobs get.
Yeah, and that's another bonus, more money in our local systems and less going overseas. Well, Doug, Craig, did you want to maybe talk about how this kind of forestry affects, the clear-cutting affects global warming?
Well, I think the obvious implication of cutting trees down is there's less trees out there to suck up the CO2, so that's always bad news. And whenever we're messing with the earth, we're also releasing carbon from the soil. So there's a lot of ways that we're creating problems. And, of course, as we hear the propaganda, they tell us that, oh, actually, no, when you cut down the trees, that's a good thing, because then we plant these little seedlings, and then they'll do a better job of sucking up the CO2. And, of course, they ignore the fact that that happens over many, many decades, and it's like you're saying, you know, spend all your money that you have, and then somehow that means you're actually going to save money. You know, it's not real logical. Yeah, I guess maybe, you know, if you spend all your money on some investment that pays off in 50 years, maybe, but by then you're dead. So, you know, and the way climate change is going, we're probably already committed to about at least a 2% centigrade warming.
Two degrees
Celsius warming, but probably much beyond that, because we're actually accelerating our progression toward the cliff if we're not already over it. The thing about climate change is you don't know until later on where you're really at because of the delay built into the system. So what we do now, you know, goes up into the atmosphere. It's like shooting bullets up in the air, and then later they come down as bowling balls and start crushing us. So we're playing a very dangerous game with the climate, and the forest is just one aspect of it, where we're looking for short-term profits at the expense of our children and grandchildren.
Well, this brings me to an article that was in today's paper about local timber industries, specifically around here, that would be Sierra Pacific Industries, are going to cash in on the carbon credits while they're denuding and deforesting the forest. They're going to actually make money, more money, and on top of, you know, the slash and burn, and that's literally what they're doing, is slash and burn, because now they have biomass cogen plants, as I call them, around Northern California, where they're actually hauling everything and burning it. And there's no possible way that can be somehow meeting the environmental requirements of AB 32. I just can't believe that nobody can do the math at the state level. What's your take on that, Paul?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, if we have a situation in which we try to feed a biomass industry with forest products, what we're doing is, unless there are very, very strict limits with no loopholes set in place at the get-go, you're creating an incentive for them to deforest the place down to beyond shrubbery in a practically bare ground, if you can use chips from manzanita and madrone even. We've always opposed the kind of biomass projects that have been floated in recent years, because they don't restrict the cutting of large trees at all. Their so-called efforts to do salvage logging, sanitation cuts, they're called hazard tree removal. A lot of other loopholes have been created that allow the biomass assembly line to be fed, and yet no restrictions.
Let me take a caller. We've got Mauro. See if I can get Mauro on the air.
Good morning.
Hey, there you are. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm on the way to a protest at the Anderson Fairgrounds, where the SPI is having the annual conference for the timber industry. And I'm just encouraging people who are listening to this broadcast, don't be faint because of the rain. Come on out. And I mean, today's the day to say something. And I'd like to say something too about the Board of Forestry and Fish and Game and others that are supposed to be protecting our forest. It's the last time I was in the Board of Forestry, information that the public had brought, which is so shunned, and it's a continuation of what's been going on for at least a decade while I've been involved in this. And I no longer see the Board of Forestry as a legitimate piece of government. And every time we go in there and sit and play by their rules, while the forest goes away, we further legitimize them. It's really time to just call them what they are, illegitimate, and fight them that way.
You're talking about the Department of the California State Department of Forestry?
What's that?
You're talking about the Department of Forestry at the state level?
I'm talking about the Board of Forestry that approves timber, that handles CAL FIRE and the timber rules. And basically, when people have a problem with timber operations, they have to end up at the Board of Forestry. Unless it's water, then you go to water quality. But the Board of Forestry basically will allow, you know, the kind of clear-cutting we see east of or west of Mount Lassen in the Battle Creek area, which is a huge dispute right now, and in the Big Bend area. How is that possible that that forest is healthy? It's not. And cancer levels are really high, too. So, you know, they want to play by scientific facts that can be manipulated, in any way. We've seen that happen so many times. One fact can be seen as polar opposite.
Okay. Did you have a question, specific question?
No, I'm just calling people up today. Please come on.
All right. Yeah, I'll speak to that, too, in a little bit and give people the specifics. All right. Thanks for calling, Mauro.
Thank you.
All right. Did one of you want to speak to Mauro's point there about the Board of Forestry?
Yeah, I could say something. Board of Forestry is the parent entity to the California Department of Forestry, which is its staff. Board of Forestry is appointed by the governor and is in charge of forest practice, act and rules in the state. It is no longer a legitimate process that we have in place for regulating logging. Back when the Forest Practice Act was enacted in 73, the arrangement was that logging companies don't have to do an EIR under CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, because the timber harvest plan got invented to be an equivalent, a functional equivalent of an environmental impact report, EIR. It no longer really is the case. One fact about that is that the Department of Fish and Game's budget was slashed by two-thirds in September of 2010 by Schwarzenegger, who blue-penciled virtually all of their budget for on-the-ground inspections in the entire Sierra Nevada range and northern interior central California, where we are here. That means no boots on the ground to keep the timber industry honest, nobody to make sure they're playing by the rules. It's honor system for them out there. How are you going to have a functionally equivalent environmental impact report if you haven't got anybody to verify the things the timber industry says it's doing, not doing?
This was one of the points that Mary Lee brought up, that the testing is inadequate as far as the runoff and the turbidity in the streams and other problems that the clear cutting is causing. And the point that Mauro brings up, the fact that we are just soaking these clear cuts with toxins, you would think that somebody would be questioning that practice. I forget how many thousands of gallons were sprayed and are sprayed on these clear cuts, both, I guess, pesticides and herbicides, which are pretty much killing the soil. It's interesting, just as an aside about how these agencies work. They were not willing to accept Mary Lee's tests. What I've heard from different government agencies is that any kind of evidence brought by the public is anecdotal, but the lack of evidence brought by them and they're just making bad assumptions seems to be all right. So I guess that's what we're talking about here as far as that whole process no longer being legitimate. As far as is there a way to, let's take the specific problem of this cap-and-trade idea that the companies practicing these kind of forest ethics or lack of ethics, is there some way we can tweak that process that we can bring more attention to this?
Well, we've got to either sue them right now or get legislation drawn to fix these protocols, these rules that govern forestry under cap and trade, because they're so broken now that it's actually incentivizing clear cutting. These rules that create so-called carbon offsets for the cap and trade market are creating an incentive to clear cut and to destroy our forests, and we've got to stop that.
Yeah, it just seems so counterintuitive that something that would be put in place to actually help reverse some of the effects of global warming and maybe make climate change, 2 degrees centigrade, most people don't understand. That's like, 5 degrees Fahrenheit or 6 degrees Fahrenheit?
3.6, yeah. Every 1 degree Celsius is 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, so
which doesn't sound like much, until you think of like the human body, and if your average temperature is 98.6, and you run a fever of an extra 3.6 degrees on top of that, you're not feeling real good, and that's what we're looking at minimum, which is a sick planet. So most of the life on Earth, life forms, plant, and animal species by the end of this century will be extinct if we continue down this road, which is kind of frightening.
And that 3.6% is going to, Fahrenheit degree increase is going to be higher in the northern hemisphere, because there's more land mass in the northern hemisphere and more moderating cooling in the southern.
Yeah,
so
we're talking
it worse here.
Yeah, we're talking averages. So you're right. Up toward the poles, we're talking maybe 5 to 10 degrees. It's humongous, and then of course you see the Arctic ice disappearing, which turns from a heat reflector to a heat absorber. So it sucks up more heat, and then we look at the rainforest maybe also turning from a carbon sink to a carbon emitter, and then all the permafrost and all the methane,
the tundra.
It's insane what we're doing. It's just insane.
And let me remind our listeners, you can't see us, but our listeners, that you can call in at 337-1885. Our guests in the studio are Paul Hughes, Executive Director of Forests Forever, and Doug Craig, local clinical psychologist and climate change advocate. That number is 337-1885. So give us a call.
I could make just one more quick point and ask your response to it, Paul. I think often this carbon trade thing has been touted as what's going to save us, but I think many, including Dr. James Hansen, feels like it's a big charade, and it really hasn't worked anywhere in the world. There's much better ways to deal with this, but it is, as you were just saying, it's a dream for the companies, the corporations across the planet, and the public has no idea. And on the local level, for people that don't understand climate change, all they see is, like you just said, with the Global Warming Solutions Act, they just see the negative implications of it. They don't see we must do something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the cap and trade, unfortunately, it's been a slow, hard lesson for me, too, because it sounds good on its face. You allow profits to be made by reducing carbon emissions. But unfortunately, cap and trade systems are like a vessel that has to hold out water, say like a ship. And you only have to have one good-sized hole in the entire hull for the thing not to function. So you've got to design it so it's leak-proof at the very get-go, or you've created incentives for it to be gamed. And what we have in California is, and the leakage metaphor can be continued very well, because if I own 100,000 acres of timberland and I can get lucrative carbon credits based on any project area I assign and submit to CARB, California Air Resources Board, for my offsets income, I can leak my clear cuts out of the project area I'm submitting and getting paid for, and do the same aggregate amount of clear cutting on my property. That's the fundamental problem with the cap and trade rules. The forestry protocols is they're leaking bad forestry off onto other parts of their own ownership and getting paid for cherry picking eligible projects they get millions for under cap and trade.
The article this morning in the Record Searchlight on this, it was amazing to look at the blogs because they went from everything from cap and trade being a left-wing and, you know, radical environmentalist scam scheme to the opposite, what we're, you know, more along what we're talking about. And I know in Europe the whole cap and trade system failed because of the leaky boat idea that, you know, if it's not done right, it's not worth doing at all because it just becomes a place to game, to speculate, to scam, and it's not functional. And you would think we would have learned that lesson if we really wanted to learn that lesson. I guess that's the other big question. So if we, you know, if our agencies, and this seems to be the case at every issue I look at, it seems like the regulatory agencies are really not working for the people. They're not working even towards the letter of the law. If you look at the CEQA laws, which basically are supposed to reflect AB 32, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if – and I see it in you know, at every level of government. I see it here locally at the county level, and then we know the state level. It's pretty bad. And then we had a Pat Morrow, that our last caller, I remember he was at a meeting a few years ago where the Forest Service was going to reclassify some lands or start shooting barn owls, or I don't remember all the specifics, but I do remember that that panel from the State Department of Forestry, and they actually recognize the CEO of Sierra Pacific Industries as helping them create the plan. So there seems to be some corruption there to me. I don't know. What's your take on
They're
that?
They're getting
kind
a lot of
thing?
Bounce right now for reintroducing fishers, Pacific fishers, which are fur-bearing animals, highly endangered in the Sierras and all of that. And reintroducing fishers is well and good, but if you're taking with one hand and giving back with the other, you know, you've at least got to be putting back a net increase in the number of fishers, and that's almost certainly not happening on Sierra Pacific's ownership. Well, let's take away the almost.
So how do we do that? Do we have a breeding grounds for brown bears, or how does that manifest itself?
Let's say stopping clear cutting would be a good start.
Oh, okay. I was going to suggest that Red Emerson maybe have a couple of cubs in his living room in his mansion there in Redding. So.
You could probably keep fishers going if you had them on sustainably harvested lands. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that. They need old growth more than any other type of habitat.
Sure.
But if you're making the area into a desert, certainly that's not going to support fishers, and that's what Sierra Pacific's doing on about two-thirds of its land over the next century.
Yeah, and that's another question that's always come to me. I'm kind of math-oriented, I guess. But I looked at what their plan was, and then I look at the map, what a checkerboard it looks like, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. If they come and cut this next section next to that one within 10 years, and then they come back another time, and those little saplings that Doug Craig was talking about, they're only 4 or 5 foot tall now or whatever, 6 foot tall. So we've got this tree farm and 40 acres here, and then they denude the whole 40 or 60 acres next to that. What's left over 30 or 40? It doesn't seem the math is right to me. It's you're taking out huge sinks of carbon in the form of trees. Then you're creating more carbon with your slash and burn cogen plants. And I just can't see the math and the scheduling just doesn't seem to jive to me.
Yeah, I'm thinking of another angle on this, and you could maybe respond, Paul, to what Doug's saying also. But I look at it, you know, for those of us that have journalism backgrounds, it's about communication, right? So the idea in a democracy that if all the truth and facts that you're aware of, Paul, was widely known and disseminated, I think we could trust the population of our nation to make intelligent decisions. But what I find is the astounding ignorance on this and so many issues that we really don't have a fully functioning media system that communicates these truths in an easily digestible manner for the average person to easily grasp. So they're susceptible to be manipulated and confused. And a lot of this stuff is just going on with, you know, just beyond, you know, behind the curtain, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
I could not agree more. I mean, media control and ownership has been trending in recent decades increasingly toward more and more media outlets, or I should say fewer and fewer, being controlled by corporations, a shrinking number of corporations. That is, we start out with a large number of independent media voices, and we're very rapidly moving toward fewer independent outlets owned by fewer corporations. And now we've got Fox News, which can just make up things on the fly and masquerades as a news entity, as a news organization, when it is nothing but bluster and opinion, and almost entirely right. Well, it's entirely right wing. It's just wrong. It's not giving people the information they need in a democracy to make informed choices. And the other networks are culpable, too. They're also unduly controlled by their advertising dollars. So,
yeah, I think Tom Hartman calls Fox News GOP TV. And I would say that's probably correct. Of course, we know that you have Rupert Murdoch, who is not the most ethical or honest individual. He's been recently, him and his son are in trouble for tapping phones in England and apparently here too, but nobody's prosecuting him here. So that kind of goes along with the corruption of the system. You know, the Fourth Estate, the media has certainly really completely failed in its job in general. That's the good thing about like community radio or public radio or public television. At least we can get some independent voices that are liable to tell us something a little closer to the truth or whatever we can ascertain as the truth. So I guess we should be thankful that we have some voices and we have the internet. There's a lot of people focusing. In fact, let me it's almost the bottom of the hour. Let me make a few announcements here while I'm thinking about it. And one of them is the event that Mauro talked about on the phone. That's the Occupy the Forest, Stop Clear Cutting California demonstration at the Shasta District Fairgrounds in Anderson. That's on Highway 273. And that's from 10 a.m. to noon, so that's not too far off, a half an hour away. So if you intend to be there, and I suggest you do, and bring your rain gear and be ready to spend a couple hours in the rain and for a good cause. So bring attention to the clear cutting, which we don't seem to be paying much attention to here. The other event today is the Forum for the Forest, and our guest, Paul, will be on that forum and be talking about some of the same issues that we're talking about here. There's eight speakers, I believe, on that forum. And that's today at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on the corner of South and East Street at the First United Methodist Church in Reading. The other thing here that I have to talk about, which I don't think I have all the information on, so I might have to wait a bit for that one. Oh, here we go. There's a talk about the shock doctrine, the rise of disaster capitalism by award-winning journalist Naomi Klein. It won't be Naomi there, but one day we might get her on this.
That'd be nice.
I've been working on that. but anyway, she's a fantastic woman and a great author and very, very active on many issues in the country and around the world. But that will be tomorrow at 2 o'clock at the Reading Library Community Room. And so that's going to be a talk, I think, and kind of a slideshow maybe or something. I'm not sure, but it might be worth going to. Well, let's get back to our guests in the studio. We have Paul Hughes, Executive Director of Forest Forever. We have Randy on the line. I'm going to take your call in a minute, Randy, so hold on. and Doug Craig, clinical psychologist from Reading and climate change advocate. Our number here is 337-1885. Let's take this call from Randy. Randy, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'm also driving on my way down to Anderson to protest at the logging conference. And I just wanted to say that the more that I study the scientific evidence of climate change and environmental degradation, the scarier that it becomes. And something that I've been realizing recently is the threat of the loss of biodiversity. In a report put out from the American Academy of Biological Science scientists, they said, 7 out of 10 biologists believe that within the next 30 years, a fifth of all species on Earth will be gone. And within the next 100 years, like half of all species on Earth can be gone. And at the same time, they note that this is a greater threat to our planet, all life on Earth, than is climate change, the ozone, and pollution, all of those wrapped together. Now, these are the biological scientists that are saying this. And so it's all driven by habitat loss. And so I would like to ask if the guest could address this. Could that possibly be true, that within the next 30 years we could lose a fifth of all life forms on our planet?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Excellent questioner. Thank
That's
you,
what
Randy.
I've been hearing and reading. Edward O. Wilson, a famous Harvard biologist and authority on biological diversity, chimes in with figures on that order of losing about half of our species in the next century. And those are based on fairly standard model climate change figures. You know, if we have a runaway greenhouse, which you don't hear anybody talking about, which is where the positive feedback loops, that is, you have a warming planet that melts the tundra release all the methane it stores, and then the methane, which is something like 26 times more intense greenhouse gas than CO2, that heats things up even more, and then there are ices on the ocean floor that are melting and releasing what they're holding in the way of greenhouse gases. It could get a lot hotter than that, and we could be knocked way down in terms of biological diversity.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, I don't know if it was Wilson, but the term age of loneliness is what we're looking at, the idea that our fellow species on the planet go away, and we can't get them back after they're gone. In fact, there's a species of seagrass that I just blogged about that, so wrap your mind around this. There are individual species, like an organic life form, that's been living for 200,000 years that faces extinction now. So you're talking about an actual living entity that has lived for 200,000 years because of climate change and other things that we're doing will disappear. That's down in the Mediterranean. And so, I mean, you look across the planet at armadillos that have lived for 5 million years, and any life form you look at, certainly we see massive extinctions among frogs and amphibians going away.
So how long will this human species be able to survive after they're gone? I guess that I think people don't make the connection. Americans especially tend to be kind of anthropocentric, I think that's a word, but they don't seem to make the connection between themselves and nature so often. And we got one more call here. I think we have two, but let's take Pamela, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. Good morning. And I want to thank you for having your really important guest on this morning and this topic. And I too just wanted to reinforce what is being said, because I'm looking at this document, just one short sentence, that it says, "The loss of a large variety of species, biodiversity, is one of our most pressing environmental concerns." And I agree that most people don't understand the ramifications of that. So I just wanted to say I think it's really important to protect our forests and to promote organic farming and gardening as part of the solution.
I just wanted to chime in and support again and say that the metaphor I like to come back to again and again is spaceship Earth. If you think of us as being in a space capsule hurtling through the void of space that's utterly lifeless, This spaceship we're on here gives us life because of myriad interchangeable parts that are like a fantastic machine that creates oxygen and life for humans and food and all the rest. And we're throwing away pieces of that that we don't know what they do. What dumber thing could we be doing than to be throwing away pieces of our spaceship when we don't even understand how they work together? And they must all work together because they are all interconnected absolutely related to each other functionally.
Yeah, and I think the arrogance, I can only think of it as arrogance of mankind in general, to not recognize the fragility of the system. It's has evolved over eons of time, and it is precise and interconnected in a way that we don't even understand. Pamela, I want to ask you, are you still on? Did you have something else you wanted to say?
No, I just wanted to thank you, and I'll hang up.
All right, thank you.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye-bye. To get back to that point, and we have another caller, but if he'll hold on just another minute, we'll take his call. But that we can believe somehow that we are exempt from the laws of nature, or that we are simply there's going to be a silver bullet to save us in the end, is so arrogant and foolish to me. So,
well, what you often hear, I know you have another caller, but what we often hear, and Paul, you probably had this experience, I know Doug and I have, which is you try to talk to someone about this, and they just immediately have this smug look and say, oh, how could human beings affect the climate, and they look at you like, you silly person, the earth is so resilient. It's been here for billions of years. And it's true. The earth is, if we believe scientists who study this, earth scientists, it's 4.5 billion years old. And it's been through a lot, and we'll probably be here many more billions of years. The point isn't that the earth will die. The earth won't die. It's that that there are some rapid changes geologically occurring right now, and we've only been here for a millisecond when you compare it with the life of the planet. We're just a very brief kind of species that's just showed up like a mosquito here that has a very short life, so it's more about preserving the unique climate that's existed that's given us a chance to thrive on the planet
and to build a civilization.
Right, yeah.
If such as it is.
Right. Yeah. What did Mahatma Gandhi say? Yeah. Western civilization is a good idea. Let's take Mauro. Mauro, you're back on the air.
The group of scientists who work in the Arctic, have international group, have formed a group, and I believe they call themselves the Arctic Methane Group, and they have declared a planetary emergency, and they're suggesting the very strong possibility that we have already crossed the methane line with the foaming water they're seeing up there of methane releases going on right now. I don't know the name of their website, but if you go to eco-occupy.com, the link is real clear there. Okay, that's it.
Okay. Thank you, Mauro. We had Professor Robert Howarth on. In fact, it was the last time Doug Craig was in the studio, and he made the point that actually recent science says that methane is more than 26, 30 times worse than CO2. And he also made the point that this whole fracking procedure that seems to be a mania now across the United States, destroying groundwater, also is releasing huge amounts of methane into the air, and plus the obvious issues that you and Mauro brought up about the methane. So, and I think Dr. Howarth made that point too, if not on the air, on a paper that he wrote, that basically short-term, the methane is going to be a serious problem because it could get past that tipping point where it'll drive itself and it'll drive global warming even faster than we even believe possible.
And as Doug Craig said a minute ago, we're not looking at the extinction of all life on Earth. We know that life can live in steaming hot fumaroles in the Earth. It can live inside of thick frozen rocks and all kinds of stuff. That kind of life will probably survive global warming, but will large animals like us survive it? It's entirely a good, you know, an open question. And then the future philosophers will evolve from blue-green algae and nematodes rather than from primates.
And the sad part, too, is that it's all this discussion we're having and this group that's meeting at the Methodist Church today at 1 p.m. to talk about the forests is often spun in this liberal-conservative range, which is absurd. This is nothing to do. If your house is on fire, it's not a conservative or a liberal issue. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's poisons in the atmosphere or in our soils, you know, it's not political. It's more scientific. It's more about ethics, morality, sensibility, common sense. You know,
common
and that's,
sense,
right? it's about survival. And
what happened to that?
And how do we all get together and work together? Because when we realize what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. Suddenly, we have this profound respect, and we want to tread lightly on it.
I would think so. Especially if we're looking at the future generations or hopefully some future generations, if we had that rapid tipping and we went in a very short period of time, say, to a 10-degree change and a, what would that be, in a 40-foot rise in sea level, the whole Earth would be in chaos and we'd be losing species, including human beings, at a very rapid pace. The Department of Defense did a study a few years back about climate change and what effect that would have socially and geopolitically, and their findings were pretty extreme because if you think about the low-lying areas of the world where so many hundreds of millions of people live and island communities, or even think about our own coast, downtown San Francisco would be under about 30 foot of water if that happened. So, you know, we don't think about the real consequences. We don't understand science in general as Americans, which is surprising. I'm the Sputnik generation, you know. So just slightly before the baby boomers. But that was a big thing when I was a young man to think that, wow, science put us on the moon and science, you know, created so much of what we have technologically, and yet these same people that kind of deny science change, they're watching their satellite TV and they're making their cell phone calls and they're, you know, using technology that they don't understand, and yet the obvious proof of the science is right in their hand. And to deny the science and to deny their own future and maybe the future of mankind just seems amazing. I know Craig has done a lot of thought and study on this. What is it about people? I find it so amazing. Is it really? I think Naomi Klein says it's not that they don't understand the science, that they actually do understand it, but they're so fearful of it, they think they have to somehow come up with a different story.
Well, I'd like to know what you think, Paul, but my view on it is that I think when you see surveys, you know, down at the bottom in terms of who they respect, you know, of course, congressmen are way down there, but scientists actually are highly respected, and as long as it's not controversial. So you know, when scientists discover some new thing that helps us conquer cancer or heart disease or some other issue that is non-controversial and everybody can get behind, you know, then we all believe in science. But what we're talking about is when science discovers that we're killing ourselves, and we're killing ourselves in such a way that there are some significant minority that's making huge profits off of that death, then that element of our society then steps forward to confuse the public mind on that issue. And that's what I think, you know, your whole life is probably fighting against, Paul, that you're just speaking the scientific truth, but it's hard because you're, when you use science, you're hemmed in by certain realities that science has rules and you can't go beyond that. You can only stick to the facts. But our enemy, so to speak, they have no rules. They can say anything, and the public is really confused about that.
Yeah, it brings me back to something I think I heard in journalism school, which is somebody said, when you're writing a story or what have you, don't underestimate people's intelligence, but never overestimate the amount of information they have. And so if they can simply get unfiltered information, people are capable of making good decisions. And again, they're not getting it because the media have been taken over increasingly. I've seen a huge amount of change in my lifetime on this. Taken over by the corporate interests that pay their bills. And the internet has robbed the traditional media of some revenue as well, but a lot of good things have come from web news. But the main thing is that we haven't got an unfettered media that is giving people the facts to make their decisions based on. If they had that, I think we'd have a lot more science awareness.
Yeah, the a central theme that seems to come up in all of the discussions we have, and we're talking about a wide range of people that I've had on the show, is basically corporate malfeasance. To fulfill their corporate charter to make money at all costs, and the lack of regulation and the lack of some sort of control over this has been detrimental to our society, our culture, to democracy, to the economy of the world at this point. And the very fact that in the face of all of that, there doesn't seem to be any change in the corporate media. You would think, or in corporations in general, that you would think that it would be to their advantage to have a future, to their advantage to promote healthy things that would be sustainable. And even the word sustainability now is getting a bad rap, like to create something that would last and be of value is somehow a bad thing. I see this on the blogs, and in the news and on the internet all the time. As soon as something that seems plausible and valuable comes up, there seems to be this wall of misinformation that follows it. And you can name it. It doesn't matter what the issue is. It just seems to follow it. And it's a kill the messenger or give, call people names and pigeonhole them so that we don't have to pay attention to the message because it's something we don't want to hear. And so hopefully we're combating that in what we're doing here today. Let me remind the callers, we only have about another 5 minutes to take calls. So if you want to call in, 337-1885. We're in the studio with Paul Hughes, Executive Director of Forest Forever, and Doug Craig, climate change advocate. Climate of Change is his blog and the Record Searchlight. So give us a call. So back to our discussion, I guess the big question always is for me is, and that I hear from a lot of people is, what can I do? I'm just a lonely little citizen out here. I don't like what's happening, but I don't have any effect. I have no power, poor little me, and I can't do anything. So it's just going to let it all go to hell. And so, what can the average citizen do to overcome some of these problems?
One thing I'd suggest is look for nonprofit news sources. That is, news sources that are, to a much lesser extent, beholden to private commercial interests for their upkeep. Look for journalists put out by nonprofit organizations that are doing things you're interested in, like the Center for Science in the Public Interest, which is about nutrition and health and eating right and taking care of our bodies and fighting against junk food advertising and so forth. That's put out by that's a nonprofit organization that has an excellent newsletter. That's just one example. If you look for relatively independent information, you still read your newspaper and make some discerning choices based on what you're going to believe. But that would be one step to take.
Yeah, and I think of James Lovelock's work with his series of books on Gaia, you know, I believe that there is this credible scientific message that the Earth is a living organism, and even though we think we're all separate, independent people, and the free market advocates would say that, you know, that we can all just pursue our own selfish interests and we'll all benefit. We kind of think that's not true, that as individuals seek their greedy most that they can acquire, we're all compromised. And so there is a life force energy in the universe and on this planet that we're all part of. And if we all seek the common good, we'll all get through this. We'll survive this. But that requires, like Paul's saying, seeking out information from sources other than what the commercial entities want us to believe and know about the world, and read books, use your intelligence, use your brain, connect with other people that think like that. Come out to the Forest Forum today at the Methodist Church from 1 to 5 and listen to, you know, smart people like Paul here to understand what we're up against, and we can all do a little bit each in our own way to turn this around.
And I would add, support campaign finance reform as well. take corporate money out of politics.
Yeah, and that's a great point. We have Seabrook from Big Bend on the air. Seabrook, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. This is a great show. Thank you for having such an important discussion. I'm living in the Medesi Valley, where the Sierra Pacific is just really destroying the watershed, and this year has been so horrendous, and I see so many log trucks. There's an unbelievable amount of spray that they're going to be using in the watershed, and I just was wondering, what is the timing on the bill that you mentioned to prevent the overlooking of the cumulative effect problem, and how can we support the passage of that legislation? Are there any rallies that you know of planned besides writing letters, when is that scheduled to be considered in California, and how can we really support that, because the overcutting is just so obvious, and the cumulative effect is so blatantly over the top that they should really be called on that. And I'm also on my way to Anderson. I'd like to encourage everyone to get in their car right now, because we've got to bring this to the industry and let them know that they are being watched, and that they can't get away with business as usual when it's destroying the whole watershed. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, excellent question. Thank you, Seabrook.
On Assembly Bill 380, the Cumulative Watershed Effects Bill, write to Wes Chesbro, Democrat from Arcata. Tell him to work to get his bill out of the Assembly or the Senate Appropriations Committee. Also to Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg and to Governor Brown in favor of Assembly Bill 380, and say in your own words why it's urgent. That bill has to be freed from that committee by the end of May or it will die. As far as what you can do to get more involved, go to Stop Clear Cutting Now, Stop Clear Cutting California, rather, all one word, .org, and our website is forestsforever.org, and you can stay posted on any events there, too.
Yeah, looks like we have a lot of people that are going out, and stay tuned to us as you go out there. And thanks for all our callers calling in. Well, I want to ask you guys for just some last words. We've only got a few minutes left. What is the prominent thing in your mind right now that you just think we need to let everybody know? Paul had some great ideas about the websites there, and of course, turning out. But let me ask Doug Craig what he thinks.
Oh, I just think you can't sit at home anymore. Whether you're out protesting today or you're going to Free Thought Center there over on Bocelli, or you're writing letters to the editor, you just can't sit down. The Earth needs us, so we got to get on board with that.
Yeah, not a whole lot else to add, I guess, except that let's stop clear-cutting, and we can get just as much wood product out of the forest by not doing it that way and concentrating the impact so intensely in one place in one time that the environment there is destroyed. Let's spread out the impacts from logging and stop clear-cutting.
Okay, well, I want to thank my guests. I want you to stay tuned to KKRN if you can. We have more local programming and lots of great music that we'll be playing today. And get down to Anderson there at the Shasta District Fairgrounds. That demonstration is from 10 till noon, and then the Forest for the Forms is from 1 to 5 at the First United Methodist Church. So we're going to go out with a local favorite. People like this song so much, so I'm going to play it again for you. This is Makana, We Are the Many.
You come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none.